what I'm going to be looking at today is found in Revelation 17. And the question, section A, that came in Revelation 17, verses 8 and 9, is this referring to the time when France was in power? Is that why the papacy was, past tense, and is not, current tense? So if France was in power during the time of Revelation 17, 8, and 10, the papacy would be the one that was, is not. Is that really what's happening? Well, that's what I have concluded in my study before when I went through the 30 parts in the book of Revelation. So I'm going to go ahead and look at that a little bit further and try to illustrate the idea of what is being said and also what potentially is not being said. So bear with me as we go through this together. In Revelation 17, verse 8, the beast that thou sawest. Now, it's talking about the beast. We must understand this chapter is dealing with a beast, but we will learn a little bit later. This beast is ridden by a woman, and that's important to understand. The beast that you saw, it was, and it currently is not. So that's past tense. This is present tense, and shall ascend, future tense, out of the bottomless pit, and it will go into perdition. And they that dwell in the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. When they behold the beast that was, past tense, currently is not, and yet is. So it is not, but it's really still there, right? Okay, verse 9. Here is the mind that hath wisdom, the seven heads or seven mountains on which the woman sits. And it says in the King James, and there are, but many translations render this, and they are, okay? And they are seven kings, and I prefer that translation. You can study that for yourself if you're interested. Five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. So the question has been raised, is this time where the beast was and currently is not? Is that time right there France? So let's go and see a couple of our thoughts here that I've been able to pull together. This is from Uriah Smith's book, Thoughts on Daniel and the Revelation. This is the 1897 version. This is the original version. Now, the reason why I say that is because, as we know, there have been some major changes in the understanding of our church in the past history. After the time that our dear beloved Ellen White died, there was some secret councils, that some Sabbath councils that they had, where in these meetings in 1919 and onward, they started discussing the book of, the concepts of Daniel 11 and the eternal sonship of Christ. And so after they went ahead and contemplated those thoughts in those private meetings there, and you can read the manuscripts at the Adventist, Adventist Archives website. You can read, I have not read them all. I've read the portions that are appropriate to what I'm talking about right now. But they did talk about Daniel 11. They talked about the eternal sonship of Christ, and they wanted to make some changes in some of the writings that were made. Well, one of the books they made some major changes in was Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith. They kept that name, although, you know, written by Uriah Smith, although it was such a different work after he had passed away, that I think it would have been more fair to add some editors onto that name rather than saying it was originally from Uriah Smith, because it was such a very different conclusion about who Christ was, about the history of some of the prophecies and the things that were written there. And so I think they did a poor job in doing that. Anyways, that's what I'm using, is the original version of Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation from 1897. So this is what he says. The beast of which the angel here speaks is evidently the scarlet beast. And we know that from Revelation chapter 17, the first few verses. It's a wild beast. So it's two things, scarlet and wild. Like the one thus introduced, it is a symbol of an oppressive and persecuting power. Total agreement. The red symbolizes, of course, persecution, just like it did in chapter 6 of the book of Revelation. And while the Roman power as a nation had a long, uninterrupted existence, it passed through certain phases during which this symbol would be applicable to it, and during which time, consequently, the beast in such prophecies as the present, the one that he's talking about in Revelation 17, might be said not to be or not to exist. Thus, Rome in its pagan form was a persecuting power. Okay, so here is the first application to what he's saying. Rome in its pagan form, that's what he's saying, was a persecuting power in its relation to the people of God, during which time it constituted the beast that was. So there's the first application, okay? Rome was the beast that was in its pagan form while it was persecuting. But the empire was nominally converted. He uses this phrase, nominally converted to Christianity. There was a transition from paganism to another phase of religion falsely called Christian. That would be during the time that, Constantine saw a vision, and that was actually in the 300s when he was able to see that vision and move his armies forward, baptizing them through going through a river, etc. Well, so, and during that time, that brief period, while this transition was going on, it lost its ferocious and persecuting character. That's the second application. That would be the time when it was said that it was not. So right there, then it could be said of the beast that it was not. Time passed and it degenerated into popery. That would be the third application. And again assumes its bloodthirsty and oppressive character. And then it constituted the beast that yet is. Or, and he makes it clear, he clarifies again, or in John's day was to be. In other words, the papacy was still coming. So I want you to understand what Uriah Smith has said here, because I think it's important to, for our understanding as we continue further. His application to the beast that was and is not and shall be was the pagan Rome when it was persecuting God's people. There was a brief time where it was not persecuting God's people, in the which he said John was living, and then another time where the power would arise as popery, and it would then be persecuting. Well, I know he said that. It's in his book. It's clear as, you know, we don't need to ask questions as to what he meant, because it is, that's what it's saying. I mean, if you understand basic English. So what happens is, I would like to consider another idea because of two things. What we read further in our notes, but also one of the questions I would have concerning what he said in this is, if paganism was the persecuting power, and then there was a transition period where John was living in where it was not persecuting, and then there would be a time in the future under popery where it would persecute again. Why, if that's the case, was John on the island of Patmos? If John was living during a time, or was there prophesying during a time where the pagan Rome, or turning Christian, wasn't persecuting, why was he on the island of Patmos? The reason why he was on the island of Patmos is because he was persecuted from the paganism that hadn't yet become Christian. So John was living on the island of Patmos. He died a few years later, and it wasn't until hundreds of years later that paganism became more Christian, and that was in the 300s. So as I read the notes, you'll be able to see where I'm coming from here. I'll just read it again, because this is kind of the thought that I had. If the persecuting power in John's day was to be, why was John on the island of Patmos as one persecuted by that pagan power, right? It seems to make better sense to me to apply these three phases to the time when the beast, which was Rome, correctly stated as Uriah Smith had said, was ridden by a woman, the papacy, as mentioned in verses 1 of chapter 17. Now, I'm going to go to Revelation chapter 17, and we're going to read there for just a moment to see what the context is. And I want you to notice what John's focus is during this time. There came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials. And he talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. So the first thing that was stated by the angel was that there was a whore. It didn't say there was a beast. the focus of this chapter, the entering thoughts, was that there is a great whore. And the great whore is not even sitting on a beast in the first portion. She's sitting upon many waters. And then it says, with whom, that whom is the woman, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Again, a reference to the woman. So far it's once here, it's another one here, and another one here. Three times so far we have a reference directly to the woman. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman. That's the fourth time that the woman is referred to. She sat upon a scarlet-colored beast. Oh, wait a minute, there's a beast here too? I thought this was all talking about a woman. No, see, we've gone into three verses so far to discuss the idea of this woman sitting on waters. The woman is making all the kings drunk with the wine of her fornication. The woman is there on a beast. It's, oh, there's a beast there too. So the beast is the focus, but the beast is a focus with a woman on the beast. That's what I think is important to understand about this chapter. It doesn't start with pagan Rome. It starts with Rome that is controlled by the woman. Okay, this is papal Rome. And so I would like to say that you have papal Rome as the one that is, that was. The time that papal Rome did not have the civil authority that she did in order to persecute was during the time that France had taken away her civil authority. And then there was another time where after that deadly wound was healed, she would rule again under the image of the beast, which is in America. So that's my understanding of what is happening in Revelation chapter 17, which I understand is contrary to what Uriah Smith has said. Now, that doesn't mean that I would throw the entire book of thoughts on Daniel and Revelation out the door. I believe this to be somewhat of a minor point. Now, some of you might throw your hands up and say, are you kidding me? This is changing the entire focus of Revelation 17. Well, it still comes to the same conclusion. I don't think that what he did was lead us to something that is false in its conclusion. He applied something differently than I'm doing right now, and I have good reason to, and you'll see in just a moment why. But it doesn't, for me, take the entire book and throw it into the heap saying that it's trash, right? So anyways, let's continue on these thoughts real quick in regard to why I'm saying that it's Rome controlled by a woman. So it seems better to make sense to me to apply the three phases, as was mentioned by the Bible, but also Uriah Smith, to the time when the beast was ridden by the woman. That would mean the papacy, as mentioned in chapter 17, verse 1, as we just read. And that would be the first application. That was the woman who, or the beast who was, to when the beast was not controlled by the woman. That would be, of course, during the time of the deadly wound that was inflicted when the civil authority was taken away from the church by France. And we know that Napoleon sent his general, Berthier, into France, and they were able to take it. And of course, we know the Pope then died years later in exile. He was actually put into a prison, and he died there. Then the beast would be controlled by a woman again. Okay, so the whole focus of Revelation 17 is the beast that has a woman on her. And that's why I'm liking this conclusion better. So the deadly wound would be healed under the image of the beast found in Revelation 13, verses 15 through 18, which we have already studied in this section. Now, you might be surprised, but this understanding actually agrees with what John N. or Nevins Andrews wrote in 1855. This is what he said. The proper period of each of the seven-headed beasts in the book of Revelation, if you go and find the context, the proper period of each of these seven-headed beasts seems to be this. The dragon, a seven-headed beast, before the 1260 years. The beast of chapter 13, which also has seven heads, during that period of 1260 years. And then the beast of chapter 17 is going to be, which also has seven heads, is going to be since the deadly wound and captivity at the close of that period of 1260 years. So according to John Nevins Andrews, what you have is three animals in the book of Revelation, each of them having seven heads. And it's different phases of the papacy, if you will. And so you have the dragon being before the 1260 years. You have the first beast of Revelation 13 being during the 1260 years, and then the seven-headed dragon at the end in chapter 17 as after the 1260 years. So that would make more sense with what I'm saying in light of the three phases there in the book of Revelation 17, where you have the woman, you have the deadly wound, and then the woman. Now, does that go in exact concert with the seven-headed beasts? No, but chapter 17 is dealing with a beast that has a woman on it. It's not dealing with a beast that later has a woman sit on it. So the beast in the application of Revelation 17 is that the woman is the focus and she is sitting on a beast. That would mandate that it's referring to the time of the papacy. And so the papacy, the deadly wound, and the healing of the wound under the American image of the beast is what I'm suggesting. And there's more reasons why I would suggest that. Not only has John Andrews written something that would be able to allow for that, but I found this as well. This was something that you can find when studying chapter 11 and 17 together. The bottomless pit, say, okay, so the bottomless pit occurs seven times. Now, but it's in verse 8 is where France came from. Okay, that's in chapter 11 of the book of Revelation. So in chapter 17, verse 8, that this beast came from the bottomless pit. Okay, that's where France came from in chapter 11. That's better what I was trying to say. Yet, we can notice from the Great Controversy, the expression bottomless pit represents the earth in a state of confusion and darkness. So two things, confusion and darkness. And it is evident from other scriptures. You can see that in the Great Controversy 658.3. So the beast in 17 does not have to be France, according to this understanding, but it comes from the same place as France did in chapter 11, which was confusion and darkness. So now the reason why John could be in vision at the time of France is because of how the chapter starts. Now, in verse 3 of chapter 17, it says that he was in the spirit. Okay, now the phrase in the spirit, it only happens four times in the book of Revelation. And in that four times in the book of Revelation, it's always used at a time and a place where John was taken to. Now, I have this word taken in kind of like single parentheses because the Bible doesn't say he was taken there to another time and another place, but you can see it. Notice what it says there in chapter 1, verse 10. It's the Bible says, I'm just going to turn there so we can read it. Revelation 1, verse 10. It says, John's writing, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. I heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet, and it was Christ, right? Christ was the one who, when he turned around, you could see him standing in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. And so looking at this idea of chapter 1, verse 10, John was in the Spirit. Jesus was there, but he was later shown as being in the midst of the churches. Now, were the churches on the island of Patmos? Were those candlesticks on the island of Patmos? The answer is no. Well, then John would have been, quote unquote, taken to where the churches were and where Jesus was in the midst of those churches. It would be, of course, in vision, but he was taken to another place, another time, and another location. The time in this situation would be after the ascension of Christ until the second coming, because the churches represent the time between the ascension and the second coming of Christ. So this time that he was in was not necessarily a specific point in time, but it was a general time era of the churches that John was taken to. And he was not taken to the island of Patmos because there was no churches on the island of Patmos like there were in Sardis and Laodicea and Philadelphia and Smyrna and Pergamos, Thyatira, etc. So now the next time that John refers to this idea of in the Spirit was chapter 4, verse 2. And I'm going to go there now to show you what it says. Immediately, John said, I was in the Spirit. And behold, a throne was set where? In heaven. And one sat on the throne. And so John was able to actually be in heaven in this I was in the spirit scenario. So John was taken up to heaven before Christ ascended through the time he was coronated in chapter 5. Therefore, starting many years before the time John was on the island of Patmos. And so basically, chapter 1 is dealing with this idea that John was taken to where the churches are, where Christ was ministering amidst the churches. It was in vision, of course, and so it was relating to another time and place. In Revelation 4, John was in heaven all of a sudden, and he was able to see the Father on the throne, surrounded by the beautiful, glorious, colorful rainbow, and he saw the living creatures and the 24 elders, and then he wondered, like, is anybody able to open the book? And then that's where the lamb or lion came in, and he saw this whole scenario, but he was in heaven. That was a different time and place, because John was already living in the 90s AD when he had the vision of Revelation. But Jesus was coronated and ascended some, like 60 years before. And so he was taken to another time, and of course in heaven, another place. Consider further as we go into 17, which is the other time that he was taken to another time and place. 17:3 is another use when Andrews, and we've already read it, so I won't read it again, but I was in the spirit and the Lord led me into the wilderness, right? It's another use when Andrews said it is after the time of the healing of the wound. And you can see that from three angels in Revelation 14, 6 through 12, page 74.1, which we've read above. The other time is in 21 verse 10. I'm just going to read that for you real quick. And 21:10 says, he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain. And he showed me that great city, the Holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Now, in the spirit here, we know that it was at a time when the Holy Jerusalem will be descending out of heaven from God. And so this whole idea of Jerusalem descending out of heaven from God was not during the time John was on the Isle of Patmos. In fact, it was 3,000 years in the future that John was able to see this city coming down from God out of heaven. And so again, John was in another time, in another place. And so could it be that chapter 17, when it's showing John in this vision, looking at this beast that was and currently is not, yet would be, the is not, could it be another time and another place other than being in Rome? I think the answer is yes. The reason being is because of that phrase, in the spirit. And so when looking at this idea, this is my own Bible study and comparing Daniel and Revelation with also John Andrews. Not to say that I'm equal with these guys or anything, but we are supposed to study for ourselves. I do not encourage anybody just to take a book and read it for itself, you know, read it one time through and say, I believe everything that book has to say. I mean, there are some books I would say that about because I've read them and I feel like they have complete truth, like The Great Controversy and The Desire of Ages and The Acts of the Apostles and the Bible itself, right? But we are not supposed to do that. We are supposed to think and pray and study and find what is right, what is true, what makes best sense to our minds, and then we're to apply those things to our lives, believing that the Lord is leading us. And if our hearts are sincere, God will lead us. He is leading us, and He will bless us. So that's my encouragement, is to study. Don't just take any book, read it, and say, this is truth because I heard somebody say that it was truth. I don't encourage that at all. We need to think for ourselves. Now, if you're out of tune with the Bible and the writings that you believe are from inspiration, then of course, reject what you've concluded and go back to where you know the light has been. Okay, so the idea continues in this question. This is section B now. If so, that phrase, if so, was it during the time that France was in power? Okay, so if it was where the beast was not, was during the time that France was in power, who are the 10 kings which haven't received power yet in verse 12? What does it mean that they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast? Now, I've gone ahead and I've brought verse 12 into the picture here so we can see what it says. The 10 horns, which thou sawest, are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet. In other words, they haven't been brought together yet during the time where John was being given this vision, during the time after obviously they would be given power after he was in that time, which is not, right? Of course, I'm saying it could be during the time of France. But they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Okay, so it's talking about they have power 1 hour with the beast. I want to mark that one there. They have one mind. I want to mark that one with bold as well. So 1 hour with the beast and they have one mind. Now, this is what Uriah Smith says about that section. He's pretty strong here. And so I want to underscore what he's saying. This language dealing specifically with what we just read, chapter 17, verses 12 and 13, this language must refer to the past when the kingdoms of Europe were united or unanimous in giving their support to the papacy. It cannot apply to the future. So these words must and cannot are pretty strong language. So I want to make sure that we understand what he's saying. I'm going to read it again. This language must refer to the past when the kingdoms of Europe are united in giving their support to the papacy. It cannot apply to the future. For, and here's the reason, for after the commencement of the time of the end, they were to take away its dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end, which you find in Daniel chapter 7, 26. And the treatment which these kingdoms are finally to bestow upon the papacy is expressed in verse 16, where it is said, they will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, burn her with fire. A part of this work the nations of Europe have been doing for years. The completion of it, burning her with fire, will be accomplished when Revelation 18 verse 8 is fulfilled. So that was his conclusion on verses 12 and 13, which talk about 1 hour with the beast and they having one mind. It must refer to the past. It cannot refer to the future. Okay, I'm even going to put that one in bold. Notice, I want to show you what Ellen White says using those phrases. These have one mind. This is how she starts her quote. There will be, that's future tense. That's the same wording that we were just told cannot apply to the future, right? There will be a universal bond of union, one great harmony, a confederacy of Satan's forces, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Thus is manifested the same arbitrary, oppressive power against religious liberty, freedom to worship God, according to the dictates of conscience, as was manifested by the papacy when, in the past, it persecuted those who dared to refuse to conform with the religious rites and ceremonies of Romanists. In the warfare to be waged in the last days, there will be, future tense, united in opposition to God's people, all the corrupt powers that have apostatized from allegiance to the law of Jehovah. In this warfare, the Sabbath of the fourth commandment will be the great point at issue. For in the Sabbath commandment, the great lawgiver identifies himself as the creator of the heavens and the earth. And so what I found here was Uriah Smith applying the time where the beast was and is not and shall be to pagan Rome, a time that John was living when pagan Rome was not persecuting anymore because it was becoming Christian, and then the papacy. Whereas I feel like that would be contrary to what J.N. Andrews said and also contrary to what Ellen White concluded. The reason why I say that is because Uriah Smith said that the 10 horns would giving their power to the beast and would continue a short space, that 1 hour. It cannot refer to the future. It must refer to the past, whereas Ellen White used those terms and those exact phrases in those verses to refer to the future. So again, I'm not saying that I throw away the entire book of Uriah Smith, saying that it's wrong and it shouldn't be studied. I think it has marvelous truth and you should study it. In this specific case where that application was just one shift off, I would shift it one section further so that it deals with three different sections other than what he did. But that doesn't mean I think that he, you know, doesn't have a good book. Anyways, I just want to encourage you all that I'm not trying to throw the book out. I believe it was and is a tool that God can and will continue to use, but I feel like I differ on that point. Now, let me clarify. If in some way I have the opportunity to learn further about what it is that Uriah Smith meant, or if he says somewhere else a little bit of clarification that would coincide better with what Sister White says and what I've also understood, which is in concert with what Ellen White says, then I would certainly say, hey, I was wrong in saying that Uriah Smith was wrong. I just didn't understand what he was saying. So I have had somebody try to do that with that section of Uriah Smith's book, saying that he was just, you know, reading commentary on that one verse and he wasn't out of concert with what Sister White was saying. But the strong language makes it kind of hard to say that for me. Must and cannot is must and cannot. I guess I'm leaving it open for you guys. Those are my answers to those questions. There was a time where she gave some pretty strong counsel to Uriah. Now, that wasn't because he had written a book or didn't write a book. It was just because of his treatment of Jones and Wagner and some of the situation that was going on during that time. And that was actually before he had put together the book Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation. I understand they did come back together and have, you know, a good time in ministry later. But there was, I believe, a time where they did have some differences. But, you know, here's the thing. Even if Uriah Smith's book contradicts in minor ways some of the thoughts that Ellen White has, I still believe everything she said about the book. It is God's helping hand. It is to be studied. God is using it. It should be published. It should be distributed. I fully agree just the same. Now, I don't think anybody's going to go be led to hell because they think the chapter 17 applies differently. I really don't think that's going to cause the loss of anybody's soul. And so I consider it a minor point. Now, if the book, for example, introduced the Trinity as though it was true, then I would have a problem with it, right? So that's a major point, but I don't think this one is. So, you know, When people in the past have brought up the idea that the book Uriah Smith's Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation is what Ellen White calls, quote, God's helping hand, I went and looked up not every, but almost every time Ellen White uses the phrase God's helping hand. And I found that lots of things are God's helping hand, but that doesn't mean those things are inspired. For example, she talks about youth as God's helping hand. She talks about pastors being God's helping hand. Well, I know, having worked in the ministry for many years, pastors are not perfect. They are not inspired. They differ all the time. But can they be used? Should they be used? Is God working with and through them? Yes, I believe they are, or he is. And so just because it was called God's helping hand doesn't mean it's infallible. That's my conclusion. And if the Lord shows me otherwise in the future, I will certainly want to listen. There is an explanation in Uriah Smith that I have not yet fully studied yet. I need to look at that further. So he talks about the seven modes of governance, okay? The triumvirate, the dictatorial, the imperial, the, you know, kingly. There's various ways that he has found the nation of Rome to rule. And I can't say that I reject that one because I haven't looked it up well enough yet. So please study that as well in his writing from Uriah Smith's Thoughts on Daniel and Revelation. But what you said is similar to how I have understood it. But that doesn't mean that it's true necessarily. I can't endorse it for myself yet because I haven't studied the other part. But yeah, keep studying. You know, people have asked, the reason why I'm being open-minded as far as the UN is concerned, and you know, because it would be easy to say, well, if they're divided into 10, then they're the 10 kings, right? So you could do that, except the problem that I have with that is this. I know that the Bible talks about all the world being come together or brought together to worship, and I believe 100% that that illustrates the issues between keeping the laws of God and the laws of man. And keeping the laws of God, proving that you serve the God of the Bible, is keeping his seventh-day Sabbath. Well, the same way, in following the laws of the land and showing that you worship the beast in his image, would be keeping the day that they've set up, which is Sunday. So I really believe the issues will be between the commandments of God and the commandments of men. Now, I never in all my life would have guessed that the way the Pope was encouraging that to be brought about would be in 2015 with Laudato Si, which was the encouragement to honor the world and prepare the world for receiving a day of rest because of the environmental crisis that are coming. Now, that was a complete surprise to me. I had no idea that it was going to come that direction. I thought there was going to be like a, and I still believe there will be, but like all the, you know, very militant Christians in America coming together saying, we need to get back to God, we need to get back to God. I never would have thought that it would have been the way it was. So if I'm looking toward the future, I have some ideas, but I feel like having looked at the past and being surprised from how the devil's trying to bring it in, like, for example, did anybody ever think that coronavirus would be the way that the world would come together at the end of time? I could say probably not, you know? And so how it's going to be that the 10 kings are brought together to finally do this last mission for the world, I can't say that I can put my finger on it.